Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Hello, friends. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program, another episode in the series of interviews we are doing with those who have submitted Friend of the Court briefs in this Supreme Court case, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. This is a key case. This is one of the most important cases that the Supreme Court has heard on abortion in a very long time. It's almost 50 years since Roe versus Wade. The Supreme Court has considered dozens of cases about abortion and various aspects of it. And the lower courts have heard even more than that. And this continues to be one of the most unsettled issues in America. But now we reach a point where potentially this decision coming down sometime in 2022 could radically alter the nation's abortion policy. So, brothers and sisters, we are going to look actually today at three briefs that were submitted in this case. And someone that was involved in preparing all three of them is our guest today, whom I've known for quite a long time. Her name is Teresa Collette, and she is a professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. That's in Minneapolis. And she comes to us today having had this long legal experience writing, and she directs the Pro-Life Center there at St. Thomas and has, of course, testified in front of various committees and authored many articles and just been a great ally in this cause for life, for family, for marriage, for religious freedom. And Teresa, it's really a joy to be with you. Thanks for taking the time to come on the program.
I'm so grateful for the opportunity to talk with you.
So let's get right into these important documents, which I have here in my hand. I'd like to start, if we might, with the one that was submitted on behalf of the Pro-Life Center there at the University of St. Thomas. And you make basically one key argument, and let me just set it up, and then you can comment on it, of course, in more detail. As we often point out to people, Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton were two decisions issued on the same day in 1973, and the court said that they were to be read in the light of each other. And where that becomes most significant, has proven most significant, is in the way that the Doe v. Bolton case defines health. We often point out, a lot of people don't realize, that Roe v. Wade actually said that the states could prohibit abortion if they wanted to in the final months of pregnancy, provided that it wasn't necessary for the woman's health. But then Doe v. Bolton defined health so broadly that it became the exception that swallows the rule. Anything related to even her age, her family, her emotional status. I mean, you could go in there and say, hey, I'm worried, I'm anxious about this pregnancy. And all of a sudden that becomes a health reason. And therefore the state could not prohibit an abortion, even in the final weeks, my goodness, even the final days of pregnancy, if you read, you know, the text literally. So you've developed in this brief a very important point. It's possible that the court can now say to the states as a result of this Dobbs case, listen, you want to protect these unborn babies, you can go right ahead and do it. Restore to the states the authority to protect the unborn, to prohibit the violence of abortion. And what this brief is saying is, okay, well, let's take account of this law, loose and broad definition of health, and let's make sure that if indeed the court does say to the states, you can now legislate more freely on abortion, that the states are not left with the impression that they are required to allow it in these cases of broadly defined health. Because in other words, you don't want this exception that swallows the rule to continue to do so, even after the policy might drastically change. Is that an adequate assessment of this argument? And if so, please expand on it for us.
That's exactly what I'm concerned about. The Chief Justice has proven to be deeply concerned about the institutional reputation of the court. And that's not a foolish concern, but he seems to overestimate public reaction in so many ways. We saw that with the Affordable Health Care Act, known popularly as Obamacare. We've seen that in some other cases where he has gone to great lengths to protect the reputation of the court. And I think often at the cost of some core values. We saw that with some of the COVID cases that came before the court and religious liberty. And so what I was concerned about and remain concerned about is that one way for the Chief Justice to appear to be accommodating the pro-life side, but end up with a result that has zero impact on the abortion industry, is that he could agree with a majority of the court that says Roe versus Wade is no longer the law of the land, and Planned Parenthood versus Casey is no longer the law of the land. And as you said, states are now free to regulate or even prohibit abortion, but only insofar as they maintain a robust health exception in those instances where they prohibit it. And that would be justified, arguably, by the fact that, as a general matter, we don't prohibit recognized medical procedures in this country. We certainly have not prohibited things that are perhaps of some questionable value. And so my concern is that the court would say, because the medical profession as a whole, as represented by the American Bar Association, or in particular, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, which is about as pro-abortion as you can get, as an organization, because they say it's a legitimate medical response, then you have to have this robust health exception. And if the court does that, then it really is a deceptive ruling to say that they've overruled Roe and Casey.
And you know, Teresa, and you bring this up in the brief, which is relatively brief in length, but powerful in argument, that there are a couple of different ways that this is abused. One is, or the evidence that it's abused. One is very interesting statistical analysis. You take a certain data set from back at the time, just before Roe, that shows that some 93%. Of the abortions in this is over 8 states, and in this data set, were done purportedly for health reasons, mental health, but nevertheless still health. So, I mean, with that kind of a number, obviously you're just slapping a label on abortion on demand, right?
That's exactly right. And in fact, there have been instances where one of the authors of one of the original abortion medical textbooks said publicly that anytime a woman is distressed by her pregnancy, that is a threat to her mental health. And therefore, it is a suitable subject of abortion based on the health of the woman. So it's deeply troubling that the court might do this.
Well, you also have the mindset, and I know that this came up also in some court decisions, but also it's in another textbook. You mentioned about the medical textbooks. Dr. Warren Hearn, for example, says, look, bottom line is pregnancy itself is a disease. So therefore, every abortion is done for health reasons, right? And so if you have that mindset, you pull up a page from the court that says, oh, well, it has to be allowed for health reasons. And once again, it's automatic abortion on demand.
Right. And we also use the instance of the California Supreme Court case in the brief, where California originally tried to limit the health exception in psychological matters, at least, to, I'm so sorry, this is the problem with Zooming. Our dog gets very excited when the postman comes.
That's okay.
It will pass shortly. But in California, they said in order to use a mental health exception, you had to have the same evidence you would have to commit that person to a mental health facility. And yet the doctors throughout the state routinely disregarded it. And it was so routine that the California Supreme Court said one of two things is happening. Either this law is so vague that the doctors simply don't understand it, or it's so ineffective that it's not permissible under the state constitution. And so that's the sort of gamesmanship that we see in the abortion industry. And it's deeply troubling.
Very troubling, very troubling. Lots of abuses, especially to the extent that this is put in the hands of the abortionist himself or herself to determine quote unquote health. Let's go on here to, a lot more can be said about that, obviously, but the second brief that I have here, you prepared for a number of different organizations, including Advancing American Freedom, Minnesota Family Council, and various other groups. And the arguments in here are very, very interesting in the sense that they show some of the damage that a lot of people don't think about that legal abortion has led to, particularly destabilization of families, and in particular, the relationship, and this, of course, is a big concern right at this moment as we speak across America, the relationship and the authority and the influence of parents over their children. And tell us about some of these dynamics that you point out in this brief, how abortion really has been destabilizing the family.
Well, of course, the United States Supreme Court surprised everyone with Roe versus Wade, but they really surprised the nation when they took the position initially that a law that would require a parent to be involved in the consent to an abortion for their minor child was unconstitutional. Because historically, the court has had great respect for the parent-child relationship. And when they ruled that in order to have a parental consent law, you had to have a judicial bypass. You had to have a mechanism where the girl could avoid involving her parents in that decision. And that could be satisfied by a court proceeding that is completely anonymous. The parents are not allowed to attend it. It has to be conducted within 5 days of the girl's request. And during that time, the court has two questions before it. One, is this teenager, hopefully a teenager, is this teenager sufficiently mature and well-informed to make the decision without parental involvement? Or two, if that's not the case, is it in her best interest to avoid involvement of her parents in the decision? Now, that idea that you will deprive a parent of their recognized constitutional right to direct the upbringing of their children through some sort of star chamber secret proceeding is stunning. It's the only instance. Perhaps there are national security, the National Security Court has similar sort of secret proceedings, but it's the only instance in American jurisprudence beyond the possible exception of national security cases where a person can lose their constitutional rights without even knowing it's happening. Wow. Everything else, they are required to have not only notice of the proceedings, but an opportunity to be heard. Yeah. And it is just outrageous that they take this position. Now, there is a petition from Idaho in the Supreme Court, a cert petition right now, where the Idaho legislature, as outraged as I am, said, if we have to do this, fine. But what we're going to do, since the vast majority of these petitions are granted on the basis that the girl's sufficiently mature and well-informed to make the decision on our own. What we're going to do is we're going to say, then the parents still have to be informed unless there is a specific finding that the girl is subject to abuse, in which case that's a rational position. We certainly don't want to endanger teens. Yeah. But the vast majority of courts that report on the rationale for granting these, clearly 80 to 90% of them in every state is granted on this idea that the girl's sufficiently mature and well-informed. The hearings on average last less than 20 minutes, according to a published report out of Massachusetts. It's unbelievable.
Yes. And so in other words, what we're saying to the court here is there are observable harms being done, harms to the very people that you're purporting to serve by having issued this court decision, but also harms even to constitutional rights. So it's both a sociological argument and also very directly a constitutional one, apparently.
That's exactly right. And you know, the abortion industry has even resisted legally in multiple cases a requirement that where a minor is the subject of rape, she's the victim of rape, they do not want to report it to law enforcement officials. They would rather the girl continue to suffer in silence than to protect her by allowing the law enforcement officials to actually investigate. And there's a wonderful district court opinion out of one of the southern states where the judge basically says something to the effect of, this outrageous proposal has been made that the court would keep secret the victimization of a young teen. And not happening in our state.
Not happening here. Yeah, right. So, well, you know, it's like, we've spoken for years and years and decades about the abortion distortion, right?
That's exactly right.
It's, of course, in the legal field, but I mean, it's across the board. In every arena, when it comes to abortion, all the rules change. All the rules change. And this is just another egregious example of that same thing.
You mentioned the election in Virginia, where parents' rights were really a motivating factor. The schools in many areas, including California, will allow and arrange for a girl to go get an abortion and lie to her parents about whether that girl attended classes.
Wow.
It's unbelievable what they do.
It really is. Well, let me look at this third brief now. Now, this was prepared on behalf of 240 women who are scholars, professionals, and also pro-life feminist organizations. I, looking through the names here, saw many of our mutual friends and colleagues and others, groups as well as individuals. Really powerful, beautiful brief. I see Helen Alvarez's name on the front here, who worked with you and others to prepare this. Let me again summarize in a few sentences what this says and then let you develop it more. Almost 20 years after Roe v. Wade, the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision reaffirmed Roe. Many thought at that time it might reverse it, but it didn't. But in that decision is the so-called reliance clause, reliance interest, saying basically, look, even if it was wrongly decided, Roe v. Wade, at its inception, women have come to rely on the availability of abortion to basically to make their way in society, okay, professionally and in relationships and so forth. Okay, this brief, in a very substantial way, takes aim at that particular assertion, because we don't want the court to use that again. Right. Say, oh, well, you know, we got to keep this legal. We got to keep this going. Women rely on it. And, you know, the more you think about it and you know, you read through these briefs and you give it a lot of thought. That's so insulting to women.
Yes.
Right. To say, look, you know, it's sort of like a paternalistic pat on the head and say, oh, yeah, you know, we're going to let you kill your children because after all, you know, I mean, how else are you going to advance in society? And this takes aim at that and says, look, first of all, women's advancement in society predated the legalization of abortion. And so you look at it from that angle. Secondly, you say, look, where's the evidence? There's no evidence that it's this reliance on abortion that has allowed women to advance to the point where they undeniably have. And furthermore, the abortion rates, as we know right now as we speak, both the absolute numbers, the ratio, and the rate of abortions in America are at historic lows. And nevertheless, women continue to advance in society, right? We have the first female vice president, for example, right now. And then finally, you know, we have all sorts of evidence that it's abortion itself that will often create the obstacle to advancing in one's education, career, or relationships because of all the harm that the procedure does. So that in a nutshell is what this brief goes into, but talk to us about it in a little more detail.
Well, you correctly summarized Planned Parenthood versus Casey as the leading opinion, what's called the plurality opinion, makes the claim that women and men have come to rely upon the availability of abortion should contraception fail. And it further makes the claim that that reliance has assisted women in their full participation in the marketplace and the public square. The only authority that the court cites to that, the only evidence they provide, the only legal authority they provide for that remarkable statement is a citation to a chapter in a book by a pro-abortion scholar. And when you actually go read the book, particularly the pages that the court cites, but when you go read the book as a whole, the author does not make that claim. What the author says is that women have been advancing in society for at least 100 years, and that advancement itself has led to a desire for abortion, not the opposite. The court seems to be saying that abortion is what is a necessary precondition, if you will, to women's expanding opportunities in American society. The author says quite the opposite. The author says that women's opportunities have been expanding throughout the 1900s, and those opportunities have given rise to women's desire and demand for contraception and abortion. We go about looking at the actual government data. We don't use any data from private sources to the extent possible because we don't want to bring in any sort of suggestion that we're cooking the evidence one way or the other. We use government data and we look at the number of women, percentage of women in the labor force. We look at the percentage of women obtaining college and other degrees. We look at the number of businesses that women own, the percentage of businesses that women own. And what we find is some years while abortion's increasing, there are some increases in that area. But other years, particularly the last 10 years, while abortion's been declining consistently and fairly steeply, we see women leaping ahead. And so there's no consistent correlation. And as your viewers know, you can't have causation if you don't have correlation. It's just made up. And we offer the statement, we don't make the claim, we offer the statement that in fact, if we really think about this issue, what it has done, the availability of abortion has written into our legal system, basically, a presumption that it is the male reproductive model that should govern our public square, that should mm-hmm. govern our marketplace for employment, that workers that can be pregnant are less than. And so we need to solve the problem of pregnancy rather than solving the problem of a workplace that discourages formation of strong families, that discourages both for men and women the opportunity to live our lives as full persons. Certainly, as St. John Paul II said, labor is a blessing. Ask those people who are forced to retire or who lose their job. Labor is a blessing, but it is not the sum total of our lives. And for our society to really accept family formation with career advancement, it requires the acceptance that pregnancy isn't a problem, that pregnancy is a beautiful and necessary part of the continuation of our culture and civilization. And to say that abortion's the solution is, we suggest that there is some evidence. We don't make the causation argument, but certainly with the availability of abortion, we've seen a decline in women's happiness. We see multiple surveys that show that women at the end of their reproductive lives have at least one child less than they wish they'd had during their life. We see all sorts of dysfunctions that may not be caused by abortion, but certainly abortion contributes to it.
You know, as I was reading this brief, I was thinking, you know, this is a beautiful visual can accompany this brief, where you got the hundreds of women, you know, standing before the court and essentially saying the Constitution does allow for all the dimensions of our vocation. If we put it in spiritual terms, you know, we are able to be mothers and professionals at the same time. Many of us are. And it's ridiculous to think that the Constitution does not permit us the space, the room to have the full acceptance of new life and the nurturing of that new life. And because of our own strength, not because of some medical procedure that does violence to our children, are able to advance to whatever position we want. So it's a beautiful, powerful brief. I think it's one of the most important ones to come before the court in this case. And I want to really thank all the women that signed on to it. I was recently with, by the way, at a pro-life event here in Florida, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota. And I noticed hers is the first name on of all these 240 professional women. And so that's really that's significant as well. If we have one more moment, one of the things you mentioned in this brief is about the so-called Turnaway study. Could you tell us what that is and how that's been used in this argument?
There is a medical facility in San Francisco that it does lots and lots of research in the area of abortion. This is a study that was funded by some foundations that are very much in favor of the availability of abortion. And it purports to show that women who are denied abortions because of viability limits, time limits, actually suffer economically, educationally, and that the turning away of women is harmful for women and their futures. The problem is it starts out with 230 some odd women. By the time that they get halfway through this multi-year study, they've lost half their subjects. And they also count women as being turned away without taking any account of women who, while turned away from one clinic, subsequently found a clinic to provide the abortion or subsequently miscarried. And so their data sets are wildly non-descriptive. And the way they go about researching it, it would not pass the test of any serious empirical study on this topic. Mm-hmm. The problem is, and it's the problem we have with a lot of data on abortion, the industry has a complete chokehold on the availability of creating that data. For example, I have written on, again, going back to the parental bypass, the judicial bypass of parents, I would love to do an empirical study of what happens in those hearings, just procedurally. What kind of questions are asked? How long do they last? I have no access to that. Only if you are a lawyer that works with the abortion industry can you get this data. Similarly, if you want to interview women about their post-abortion experience, it is extremely difficult without the women self-identifying for those studies to get any data, because the abortion industry, the first thing they do is they put all of that secret And that's true in litigation too. Father, you know that. That's one of the first motions they make is to close the record. We just finally had some success in the case that went up to the Supreme Court recently on abortion in getting some of the things they had hidden away, had the court given them an order that said they couldn't even reveal New York Times articles they were using in the court. Really? I mean...
Well, yes. And well, as you know, Teresa, this is why in a lot of this analysis of the impact of abortion, it's so helpful to have studies coming from other countries where the information actually is better kept, better record keeping on this and better availability of the information than we have in the United States. And
that's exactly right.
So it's truly an international effort. Well, we're out of time, but friends, we've been talking with Teresa Colet, who teaches at the University of St. Thomas Law School and really has done a tremendous job with these three briefs submitted to the Supreme Court in this Dobbs case. Teresa, thanks for sharing with us the understanding of these briefs and for all the work that you have done over the decades and continue to do for life, for family, for religious freedom. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm delighted to be included. Thank you so much, Father, for all the work you do.
You're most welcome. Friends, stay connected with us. And I remind you of our special website, supremecourtvictory.com. Go there for the ability to read all of these briefs that have been submitted in support of the state of Mississippi and its pro-life law, and to see other interviews with people like Teresa and other friends of the court in this case. And also you'll see at supremecourtvictory.com our prayer campaign for victory in this case. This is Father Frank Pavone of Priests for Life. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you soon.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.